Well, I never thought I'd say it, but I agree with Al Sharpton.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
You know, it has been my commitment for years to wade into controversies, difficult issues, and to do so in a redemptive way, to walk the fine line where there can be potential misunderstanding, but to do things in a way where we listen to each other and we learn from each other. That's what I want to do today. And I want to talk about the mentality of being a victim, victimhood status, and how defeating that is in our lives, in our families, in our culture. Michael Brown, welcome to The Line of Fire today. Here's the number to call to get involved in the discussion, to agree with me, to disagree with me, to give your own input. 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-348-7884. A few years ago, I got a book by an author I had not heard of before, and the title of the book was Brainwashed. The author was an African-American who had been involved in PR work, advertising, for many, many years. And he said things, he brought things from a particular perspective that were things, well, frankly, I could have never said, and I wouldn't have the right or authority or the background to say it. But he claimed that there had been such a history of white privilege over blacks, and a mentality had been developed that was a destructive mentality. He said this, and the author's name is Tom Burrell. Maybe some of you have heard of him. The name of the book is Brainwashed, Challenging the Myth of Black Inferiority. Now, we'll start there. But this is not just a black or white issue. When you deal, say, with Palestinian Christians, they often will speak from a victimhood perspective. Many of us who have had certain backgrounds where there have been difficulties or negative history, we can develop that. If you've been hurt by the church, if you've been hurt by your own family, you can develop a victim mentality, and that is never conducive to spiritual growth or just growth as a person. So Tom Burrell said this, and I'll tell you where I happen to agree with Reverend Al Sharpton in a moment. He said this, speaking as a black American to other black Americans, "We are strong, survivors of the Middle Passage, the whip and the chains. We have survived centuries of terror, humiliation, vilification, and deprivation. We are smart. Even when our literacy was illegal, we learned, quickly invented, discovered, built, taught, and excelled against all odds. We are creative, making a way out of no way and constantly birthing and rebirthing American art and culture. So then why, after all this time, when calculating the achievement of the American dream, are we still ranked at the bottom of almost every good list and at the top of the bad list? Why, despite our apparent strength, intelligence, and resourcefulness, do we continue to lag behind and languish in so many aspects of American life?" He says the answer is intricately linked to the hundreds of years blacks have lived with white guilt and black shame. It lurks just beneath, the surface of the American consciousness like a cancer that can't be healed because it can't be discussed honestly and openly. 45 years in the advertising industry have given me personal and professional insight into the power of propaganda, positive and negative, and the use of words and images to influence, change, and even transform people's lives. The knowledge and insights I've gained have inspired me to provide an honest discussion in the book that the healing process can finally begin. Where does it start? He says it starts with realizing that you've been brainwashed. So here is the big question. For you as an individual, whatever your color, your background, for you as an individual, for your family, for your congregation, for your racial or ethnic group, if you have been a victim, if you have been oppressed, how can you move forward and overcome the victimhood mentality? Because as long as we're going to blame someone else, we'll never move forward. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
How many times was he shot? And where was he shot? And while he lied in the street for several hours, that was a kind of a state execution.
That was the voice of Jesse Jackson. He was on the air on Sunday, Fox News. Chris Wallace having a discussion between Dr. Ben Carson and Reverend Jesse Jackson about the shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson. Yes, it is interesting when it's the person with my name. Of course, it makes me feel the humanity of the situation all the more. And in point of fact, we want to use this here. We want to use this to learn, to grow, to make this a teachable moment, to listen to each other. When I say each other, I mean all of us, and have a constructive conversation. 866-348-7884. Jesse Jackson had made the state execution comment earlier. And then when he was asked about it, challenged about the language used, he explained, well, this is what happened. Now, Michael Medved, who was Jewish, who was white, wrote this. He quoted Jason Riley from the Wall Street Journal, who was on his show, and he said, it's easy for a black male to keep himself from being shot by a white cop. It's much harder to keep from getting shot by other black men. Now, does that sound like an outrageous, ugly, insulting comment, or is there a point that's being made? Excuse me, Riley's point is that if you show respect and don't try to challenge a police officer, he may still insult you, but he won't kill you. Some would dispute that. That's what we're going to have a discussion about, mentality, attitude. Michael Medved said this. In fact, an African-American is 60 times more likely to be killed by a fellow African-American than he is by a white cop. 60 times. And more whites than blacks are victims of deadly police shootings. These tragic numbers make media obsession with Ferguson, Missouri, even less defensible. Police risk their lives daily to try to stop black-on-black crime that affects every big city. When it comes to keeping black youths from violent death, police aren't the problem. In fact, they're a crucial part of any solution. Now, could it be that Michael Medved is accurate, but you would say insensitive? Now, here's the question. We still don't know what happened in Ferguson. We still don't know. All right? You may be sure. You may be clear on your interpretation of what happened, but we still don't know. We all agree that we want justice to be done, correct? We all agree that we want there to be justice, that we want there to be, if there is evidence that the policeman acted wrongly, then there should be a full trial, and there should be a fair trial, where everyone can say, whether we like the outcome or not, justice was done. I think we agree with that. I mean, we always want mercy for people's salvation and personal life, whatever's going on. But we want justice. We want there to be righteousness. We want there to be equity. We don't want there to be two standards, one for a white man, one for a black man, or one for a black man, one for a Hispanic man, or one for a Hispanic man, one for an Asian man, or one for a Jew, or one for a Gentile, or one for a man, one for a woman. We want there to be justice. Correct? Agreed? So the big question is, what if there is a victimhood mentality that any of us have bought into? What if that's the case? Doesn't it paralyze us from moving forward? Look, everybody's been, if you stay around long enough in church life, you're going to get burned. Someone's going to hurt you, or someone's going to disappoint you. You're going to be on the wrong end of a church split, or your family's going to be hurt, or a leader's going to betray you, or something. And I know people who have remained bitter for years. I know people who have remained bitter and ineffective and on the sidelines for years because they are just going to ascribe blame. Even if the blame was rightly ascribed, you must still say, nobody else is responsible for my life. Nobody else is responsible for my spiritual well-being. No one else is responsible for my economic well-being. Everyone could try to beat me down. The whole world could try to beat me down. If I love God and honor him, he'll take care of me. And every stumbling block will become a stepping stone. Well, Reverend Al Sharpton, whom I do not remember quoting in the past and saying I agree with him, He spoke at the funeral this weekend for Michael Brown, and many national leaders were in attendance. In fact, the Obama administration has been criticized that we sent three official representatives of the White House to the funeral, whereas we sent none to the memorial service for the slain American journalist James Foley, and none to the funeral of Lady Margaret Thatcher, which raised bunches of eyebrows. But here, Al Sharpton will lay out what I would say is a common mentality, theme, grievance that many African Americans would say in terms of unequal treatment, in terms of police doing what they want and acting excessively towards Black Americans. First, he lays this out. Then he makes some comments that were startling, and I think we're right on. So first, let's listen to this lengthy clip. It's about a minute long, where he lays out his case. It's going to be clip number 11, Joey, where he lays out his case about police brutality against Black America.
In 3 weeks, we saw Marlon Pinnock, a woman in Los Angeles, laid out on the freeway, Congresswoman Maxine Waters. A California Highway Patrolman hit her 15 times on video with no weapon in her hand, nothing, no threat to her. Right after that, a man, they said that he had Lucy cigarettes, and they put an illegal chokehold on him. Man videoed it 11 times. He said, "I couldn't breathe." And the man, a policeman, wouldn't let him go. Later that week, we see Michael laying on the ground. America, it's time to deal with policing. What does it require of us? We can't have a fit. We got to have a movement.
All right, now, very interesting what he ends with saying is we can't have a fit. In other words, the riots or the looting or things like that. We have to have a movement. And here's where it really gets very interesting. Let's listen to Al Sharpton speaking at the funeral in Ferguson, Missouri, clip number 12. Now he begins to point the finger in an unexpected direction.
We have to be outraged by our disrespect for each other. Our disregard for each other. Our killing and shooting and running around gun-toting each other. So that they're justifying trying to come at us because some of us act like the definition of blackness is how low you could go.
Wow.
Blackness has never been about being a gangster or a thug. Blackness was no matter how low we was pushed down, we rose up anyhow.
All right. Well, I've got time for one more quote. Let me get right into it, and then we'll discuss it on the other side of the break. Tell me what you think about what Al Sharpton had to say, whatever your own racial background, ethnic background is. Clip number 13.
Blackness was never surrendering our pursuit of excellence. It was when it was against the law to go to some schools. We built black colleges and learned anyhow. When we couldn't go downtown to church, we built our own AME church and our Church of God in Christ. We never surrendered. We never gave up, and now we get to the 21st century. We get to where we got some positions of power, and you decide it ain't black no more to be successful. Now you want to be a call your woman a. You've lost where you come from.
Yeah, he used the N-word. You want to call yourselves an N and call your wives an H. H-O is the word he used there. Disparaging slang for prostitute. what do you think about what he had to say? 866-34-TRUTH. And the larger issue, whatever state you find yourself in today, if you are going to blame anyone for your condition and then put the onus of responsibility on them to move you ahead, I can guarantee you, you will never get out of the situation. Even if all the people that you talk to, point to, have hurt you and have helped put you in a negative situation, the question is, how do you get out of it? I can tell you, it's not by the victim mentality. All right, we'll take your calls when we come back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right, let me say it straight and plain. Life is not fair. Life is not fair. The government is far from perfect. Church leaders are far from perfect. Parents are far from perfect. Employers are far from perfect. And on it goes. Even with the best intentions around us, life is still not fair. You're going to be betrayed. You're going to be hurt. You're going to be beaten down. You're going to be taken advantage of. You're going to do something and someone else is going to get credit for it. Someone else is going to get something that you deserve. On and it goes. That's what happens in life to some groups, to some individuals, more than others. But if we're going to point the finger at others, and then if we're going to say it's up to you to get me to where I am supposed to be, we will never get there, ever. 866-34-TRUTH, Michael Brown, expressing some agreement for comments made by Reverend Al Sharpton this past weekend at the funeral service for Michael Brown. Again, I desire to see the truth come to light, for there to be justice, and for everyone on all sides, wherever there are sides, to learn from this and to move forward. It's not for the police to say, well, you don't know what we have to deal with. If this officer acted wrongly and used excessive force and killed someone in cold blood, it doesn't matter what excuses he had, he's guilty. And if the young man actually attacked the police officer and the police officer was shooting trying to stop him, then you can't point to other cases of abuse in other places, and everything must be looked at individually. But then we all need to step back and say, what can we learn from this to move forward as individuals, as people? Because I'll say it again, the victim mentality is absolutely antithetic to growth and progress. And if we do it on a national level, we will never move forward. Last point, and then right to your calls. Go through the New Testament and see how everything that comes against us, everything meant for evil, ends up being turned for good. Everything, we go like lambs to the slaughter. Tertullian said, the faster you cut us down, the faster we grow. The blood of martyrs is the seed of the church. Crucify the Son of God. He rises from the dead. Let's start in Washington, D.C. George, welcome to the Line of Fire. My ears are wide open, sir.
Thank you for taking my call, and thank you for taking on such a hot topic today. I wanted to deal with or respond to Al Sharpton, those messages you just shared over the air. I think the movement that he's referring to is not just a kind of one-pronged approach to a movement. I think that the one clip that appeared to have the need to deal with the police department, and then another clip that appeared to have a need to deal with us as an African-American race, what I hear is that there's no one remedy. for the problems that we face in the African American community. We could deal with ourselves and try to raise ourselves up. However, in the process of doing that, if we're not dealing with it legislatively, if we're not dealing with it spiritually, then we're not really covering all of the bases that's going to make us whole. We would be still yet a fractured race trying to move forward in a movement. So mm-hmm. I think that it's vitally important that we deal with all of the areas that we need to deal with, and that includes us in and of ourselves as a race. But it's not just limited to that.
Got
it. That's what I heard from those clips that you shared.
Hey, George, thank you so much for weighing in. I appreciate the constructive comments very much. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Lisa in Jamesville, Virginia. Thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Hi.
Hello, you're on the air. Hello, Lisa.
Hello.
Yes, you're on the air.
Okay, great. I agree with you 100%. I think it's great that you're talking about this topic in such a profound way. I recently was having a conversation with some colleagues who said that they're still talking about slavery, and each of their skin colors would indicate where they'd be located in the cotton field or what chores they would be doing. And I felt very uncomfortable, and I'm like thinking to myself, they have to kind of get out of their own way, but it's almost like they have been brainwashed and that this is the way they still believe in 2014. So I agree with you 100% with your commentary, and it makes sense.
Yeah, well, Lisa, thank you for sharing that. And of course, that's striking to hear in terms of people going back to look at the past on that level. But listen, I understand as a white American that there are a lot of obstacles that a black American has to overcome on average that I don't have to overcome, that I didn't have to overcome growing up. I understand that. And even growing up as a Jew in America, I didn't have all kinds of opposition or attack. I mean, other Jewish people may have in terms of neighborhoods they grew up in and so on. So I'm not claiming there's an equal playing field. I'm not claiming that for a split second. I'm talking about the way forward. Follow me? I am not justifying anything or claiming that there's no reason for complaint or concern. I'm saying as long as I have the victim mentality and I'm blaming others and then I'm expecting others to move me forward, it'll never happen. I have to basically determine, okay, somehow, by God's grace, I've got to get out of the situation that I'm in. If somebody threw me in a pit, okay, then I got to figure out a way to get out of that pit. And I can't expect the person that threw me in the pit to be the one to take me out, okay? It's a harsh illustration in many ways, but I'm using it. All right, stay right there. Phone lines are jammed. We'll continue this discussion, but I don't want to cut any of you off, all right? So stay right there. Run on the other side of the break. We'll continue our discussion. For those that will be losing me in a minute or so, you can continue listening online at AskDrBrown.org. Just click on Listen Live. You'll see it right on the homepage. You can do it on your smartphone, your tablet, your PC, or catch the audio later by going to AskDrBrown.org. Click on Latest Audio. But stay right there. I want to get to all of your calls and not have to interrupt you. Take advantage of something very important. I don't know any issue that plagues people more than issues of sexual purity in terms of a moral issue that men and women in the body, in the world, have to deal with. Tremendous teaching by Joe Dallas on reclaiming sexual purity, reclaiming godly sexuality, heterosexual, homosexual issues addressed. Very, very important teaching. It's a full six-hour class. To take it in person would have cost you $40 or $50. The CD is $25, but it's yours for your gift of any size. You listen to it on your computer or your MP3 player. So call right now, 1-800-278-9978. Your gift of any size, 1-800-278-9978. The entire six-hour class on CD.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown.
your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks for joining us today on the Line of Fire. We're doing our best to wade through difficult issues, but in a teachable way. And please, if you can understand that I want to do my best to allow people to express their viewpoints, whether I agree with the viewpoint or not. I want to give people an opportunity to express their viewpoint. If I say, great comment, I fully agree, then obviously you know where I stand. But unless someone makes a downright ugly comment that I have to refute, I want to let people speak. So do your best to have that same attitude, to listen to each other, because we're going to make this as constructive as possible. So we'll go to the phones momentarily, but as we talk about the victimhood mentality, one of my friends, Jewish believer, she and her husband were at the home of a Palestinian Christian, believes she had recently met with or been in contact with Chinese Christians who had suffered terribly for their faith and yet had an attitude of overcomer and faith, and whatever comes our way, we're going to rise above it in Jesus, and the persecution is only going to make us stronger kind of mentality. And she sat in the home of a Palestinian Christian. This is not all Palestinian Christians, but she sat in the home of this particular Palestinian Christian. Their home was much nicer than the home she had in Israel as a Jewish believer. And she was dismayed by the constant blaming of Israel for their situation, and it was victimhood, 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 as opposed to we find ourselves in a difficult situation and we disagree with Israeli policies, but we're believers, and we're going to take this and rise above it. That's the key thing, the attitude with which we respond to oppression, to injustice, and how do we make progress. So your thoughts on the Al Sharpton clips that we played, as well as specifically addressing the topic of victimhood. Let's go to Queens, New York. Andrea, thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Yes, my name is Andrea. I'm a French-American Christian, and I live in a prominently black neighborhood in Queens. My husband's Italian. And because of all this turmoil in the country, I actually happen to believe with Reverend Al Sharpton saying that they're their own victims, because we have trouble even getting out of our house during this turmoil. We, like I said, live in a prominently black neighborhood, so we get scorned a lot when we walk out. We actually moved from our old neighborhood and looked for a new church in our new neighborhood. And it's a prominently black church, and when we walked in, we were asked if we were in the right place. Now, had we done that at our old church, we would have been ostracized. Now, my point is this is, yes, we're a white couple, white Christian family living in a black neighborhood, but yet when we walk out, they're all victims, and we're the enemy. I happen to strongly agree with Reverend Al Sharpton. It's nice to know that someone from his community actually spoke up and said something. Stop acting like a victim.
Got it. Hey, all right. Andrew, thank you. Thank you for the call and for sharing that. I appreciate it. 866-34-TRUTH. I hate the fact that we have a them and us discussion going on right now. I mean, that's very painful as I'm hearing it. But let's talk through it and get to where we need to go. All right. I'm making an exception and having someone on that was just on the air the other day. Joanne in Center Reach, Long Island, thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Thank you for having my call, Dr. Brown. And I just want to say I totally agree with Reverend Sharpton's statement. And as an African-American male, I am a born-again Christian. In fact, I am a pastor. And I just find it very disheartening when I hear some individuals from Latin America speak on behalf of Black Americans being brainwashed and so on and so forth. And I think that there has to be a reality in white America that no matter what you do as an African-American, even if you do change your situation, that racism still exists.
Yeah.
I mean, my aunt is 77 years old. She was, a part of the civil rights movement. So if my aunt is still alive and she was a part of the civil rights movement, there are
people. Yeah, and sir, I'm sorry, I've got to jump in, but I fully agree. There is a lot of racism still in America. No question about it. That's why I said I don't think it's an equal playing field. The question is, how can it be overcome in our personal lives? Be right back.
God of light, hear our cry. Send the fire. It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
There is a discussion with Dr. Ben Carson and Reverend Jesse Jackson, hosted on Fox News Sunday by Chris Wallace. And Ben Carson had some interesting observations. Now, you might think that he was raised in the midst of total privilege. You might think that he was raised in the midst of affluence and raised in the suburbs with a wealthy home and the best education. That appears not to be the case in terms of some of where he grew up, some of what his situation was. But listen to what he has to say. Clip number two, Dr. Ben Carson.
If you take race out of the issue altogether, and you take a group of young men and you raise them with no respect for authority, not learning to take on personal responsibility, having easy access to drugs and alcohol, they're very likely to end up as victims of violence or incarceration. It has nothing to do with race. Is there racism? Are there problems? Yes, yesterday, today, and tomorrow. But we need to start looking at bigger issues here.
In other words, there's nothing essentially different about a black person, a white person, a yellow person, a red person. There's nothing essentially different about an African-American, an Asian-American, Hispanic-American, a white American, a Jewish American, a Gentile American. In terms of ultimately our genetic makeup, we are all human beings. And the question is, in what environment are we raised? And how will we respond to the challenges that come our way? If the authority figures are harsh, if the authority figures are oppressive, you still treat authority with respect and then grow up saying, okay, somehow I have to change this system. But you still teach respect for authority. Doesn't matter. Listen, if you don't have respect for authority, the whole system collapses. If there's not respect for parental authorities, respect for teachers' authority, respect for police authority, respect for governmental authority, because we differ with it, or it's unkind, or it's harsh, or it's oppressive, then we just decide, hey, when we're going to obey and when we're not going to obey, and social structure completely collapses. As believers in particular, we're called to a higher standard. And as believers in particular, we have promises to overcome. If you go through scripture, you will see that all of the greatest adversities, difficulties, challenges, monstrous attacks against God's people, which were consistently the underdogs, have just been opportunities for the gospel to go forward in a greater way and for growth. You know the saying, if it doesn't kill you, it's only going to make you stronger. That has to be the mentality. But if my mentality is, I'm going to blame someone if they don't make my life better. I'm going to blame someone if they don't help me economically. I'm going to blame someone rather than say, okay, they're not helping me. There is unfair treatment. There is injustice. How can I respond constructively? That is the bigger issue. And it's a point that I raised in my article last week on five obvious lessons to learn from Ferguson, where I explained, first, racism clearly it exists. It's deep and wide in America. Let's not deny it. Let's face it head on and work towards fixing those issues. Secondly, there's a lot that white America doesn't understand. White America, a lot of it does not understand racial profiling, does not understand different court sentences, one for black, one for white. Doesn't understand police treatment and things like that, that can come the way of a black American that may not come the way of a white American. And the many black Americans don't understand, don't get it, that there should be more outrage, as Al Sharpton did rightly say, about the greater problem, which is the destruction of the community from within. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Boston. Carlene, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Yes, hi, Dr. Brown. Good afternoon. I was just calling because from a comment that a caller made today, it's like she's in denial that we're still being, profiled by the color of her skin. because this happened to me last week. I was in, you know, the Whole Foods, and I was there at the counter before, you know, a white male. And I'm explaining my situation to him. He totally ignored me and went ahead and asked the white man, how can I help you? And, you know, the young man said, I believe that I was there first to be served. So in other words, just because I wasn't dressed professionally as he was, even though I'm a professional and by the color of my skin, he overlooked me and went ahead and dealt with the other man instead of me. So she had called in saying that, she, you know, get over it, slavery, you know, had been abolished and everything, but I still feel that it still exists, as what you were just saying earlier. So I just wanted to voice my opinion on that.
No, Carlene, thanks for doing that. And of course, the guy may not have liked women. You know, it could have been you were profiled as a woman. You don't know.
But I think
what she was saying was that she was uncomfortable in a conversation with other African-Americans who were saying that they can tell by skin color where they came from in slavery. I thought that's what she was saying. But if she was saying there is no, of course there is racial profile. Of course there is. Now you know, the other thing, Carlene, I've experienced sometimes being in a predominantly black environment where I got second-class treatment because I was the minority guy in that situation. But overall, I fully affirm, I agree that there is racism. It remains that there is racial profiling on average that a black American will experience, that a white American will not. So we always have to remember that when white America looks on and says, I don't get it. What's their problem with the police? All the police are good guys. I wish they were all good guys, and many of them risk their lives for justice, but you got plenty of bad apples, unfortunately, like in every other situation. But again, the question is, okay, that's true, and thank you for the call. That's true. What are we going to do about it? That's the issue. And where's the greater concern? Look, when I hear all these issues about, you know, the school system is this and the school system is that, I still know ultimately that education starts in the home. And if a kid comes from a broken, messed up home, that kid goes to school with a lot of weight and pressure on them already. And if they come from whatever color they are, and there's they don't know who their father is, their mother's on drugs, whatever the color, this is universal. This is not just color related, okay? And they're in that environment. They go to school. It's very, very tough for them to focus and learn or have an environment where they go home and they get reinforced and so on. So what do we do? Well, now we have to start in the home. And whose fault is that? Ultimately, that's for us to begin to pick up the pieces one step at a time and address these issues. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Thomas in Providence, Rhode Island. Thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
How you doing, Dr. Brown?
Doing well, sir.
I just wanted to comment, you know, it's really frustrating, you know, when we see tragic situations like this shooting that took place in Ferguson. A situation where you have a young teenage boy laying out in the middle of the street for about a five-hour period with no rescue, no fire trucks, no EMTs, you know, shot like a dead dog. And, you know, people are talking about, you know, trying to figure out what happened. And the way that I see this covered by the media, including talk radio, and also the response from the police department, I want to try to see if I can give a crude analogy to try to make some of those who claim they don't understand the frustration and, you know, people who should know better, you know, as an adult, and, you know, people who might not be able to understand the frustration because of the way that they're being bombarded, how they should think about things by the media. It's sort of like if you and I are in a room together, okay, your wallet is on a table. I steal your wallet and put it in my pocket. You know I stole your wallet. You know it's in my pocket. But I'm going to try to convince you that you lost your wallet and that I'm here to help you look for your wallet. And then I'm going to ask other people to come into the room so that they can help you and I look for your lost wallet. Now, you're frustrated because you're frustrated because you know you didn't lose the wallet. You know I stole the wallet. And I'm going to avoid having you make the statement of, well, prove that I stole your wallet. What I'm going to say is, you need to prove to me and everybody else that you did not lose your wallet. And we're going to search this room together until we find it to prove that you actually lost it. And then I'm going to say, well, perhaps you didn't come into the room with the wallet. Maybe you left the wallet at home. Now, here in, I live in New England, and we had a case some years back, a guy by the name of Charles Stewart, who claims that he took a wrong turn down a street in a black neighborhood in Boston. And he says that a black man shot his wife and killed her and robbed him. The media went ballistic.
Hang on one second. We'll come. I want you to stay there through the break. You know what's fascinating, Thomas? My perspective is the exact opposite. In other words, what I hear in the media is the cops are already convicted and the kid's innocent just because that's the way it always goes down. That's what I hear overwhelmingly. So interesting differences here. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
It all comes down to families, culture, personal responsibility, all of these things, which we don't hear anything or much about. And this is what drives the poverty.
That is the rapper Bizzle. By the way, he's got some very penetrating lyrics on some of his songs. And Bill O'Reilly making a statement that some would consider to be oversimplistic. So, Thomas, I thought you gave a great analogy to explain the frustration in terms of the wallet. I thought that was an excellent analogy that really helps people get in the shoes of black Americans in terms of dealing with the police, dealing with the justice system. I'm not disputing that that is a strong perception and that there are reasons for it. My only comment right at the end as we were cutting out for the break was that the media coverage I've seen has overwhelmingly condemned the policeman. He's guilty. Everything points to it. Jesse Jackson saying it was a state execution. The attorney for the family saying he was executed in broad daylight before saying he wanted justice. So I'm actually hearing kind of the opposite through the media coverage, but let's get back to this.
Okay.
You can allow me to
address that and also to continue this analogy that I'm trying to make as far as the media is concerned, because I wanted to point out,
go ahead,
we went
we're just short on time, but go ahead.
And that's the frustration too, is that I can only do this in sound bites. I wish someday to meet you and pick your brain and, you know, maybe some time talk as a guest where we have more time to go back and forth. But like I said, here in Boston, we had a situation where the state of Massachusetts was ready to change the law back to reinstate the death penalty because this guy was claiming that, you know, some black guy shot and killed his wife and he was robbed, and they made it legal for police to violate the Fourth Amendment, and they went in. I mean, you had pictures of people, cops on horseback that were just, you know, shoving people up against walls and stripping them. And they came up with a guy that they were going to send to death row until this guy's brother-in-law, you know, told the truth, that this guy killed his own wife and came up with this story. You had Susan Smith, who drowned her children. And she claims that some black guy carjacked her, another stereotype. Geraldo Rivera and everybody else in the media did programs on carjacking and thugs and so on and so forth. My point that I'm trying to make is that this is a tragic situation about a young man that got shot, and everybody wants to talk about everything else. I mean, and use things like, well, you know, what about black-on-black crime? You know, there's more, 51% of African-Americans kill African-Americans. Okay, so what's the percentage of white Americans that kill white Americans? And especially when the FBI statistics are, you're more likely to be murdered by somebody you know. I mean, these are like, you know, different kinds of ways to make people, you know, believe things. But to your point, if I may, about, are you there, Dr. Brown?
I'm listening.
I'm sorry. To your point about having the police officer already convicted, it's really amazing that, you know, we had a situation where you had a grown man shoot up a school and kill a bunch of little kids. And you had a guy shoot up a movie theater. You had a guy shoot a congresswoman in the head. We had more information the day after those events than we had 2 weeks after this particular event. We had more information on what happened on 9/11, who the hijackers were, how they used box cutters to hijack the planes that were hijacked, a week after 9/11 than we do 2 weeks after this. The reason why people are talking about the situation as an execution and so on and so forth, they're going based on the information available. You have
all right, so sorry, I got to jump in, Thomas, okay? I've let you speak quite extensively, and I appreciate the points you're making. Look, on the one hand, I read a stat earlier that Black Americans are 60 times more likely to die at the hands of another Black American than at the hands of a police officer. Hang on, let me finish. I didn't interrupt you.
I'm sorry. You're right, Dr. Brown. Right. I'm sorry.
All right. So listen, I know it's volatile, and I know I risk things by talking about it, but I am determined to talk about them because we got to learn from each other. So listen, I'm not downplaying a word you're saying, not a word, okay? Let's look at serial killers. All the serial killers you mentioned were white. There's a large percentage of white serial killers. What does that tell us? See, I'm not making any racial equation about anything. All I'm saying is how we address it is the key issue. So here's the big thing, and
can
I think we can agree on.
You allow me to close out with this point, Dr. Point, and Dr. Brown, and I'm just going to listen to the program. I just want to make one last quick point.
It's got
to
be really quick because we're almost out of time. Sure. All right.
Sure. I just want to address the position. I want everybody out there to realize one thing. Black people aren't all one thing. Because you hear one African-American speak, that doesn't mean that we are all, that represents the whole tribe of animals. That's one. Two, not all African-Americans live in the housing project. As a matter of fact, it's a small minority when you think about the population of African-Americans. We don't all live in housing projects. We're not on welfare and food stamps. We are a hardworking, group of people in this country. It's just unfortunate that we do not control, the perception of ourselves in the media, how we're being talked about, and so on and so forth. So Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, these guys are activists. They're not political.
No, I understand. Hey, listen, I got to jump in because I'm out of time. Stay right there. Just listen to what I have to say. I appreciate the points you make very much. Otherwise, I wouldn't have let you speak as long as you did, okay? I appreciate the points you're making, and they're points that need to be heard. The whole point of my show is this. If any of us, white, black, yellow, red, whoever, Hispanic, whatever, if any of us have the victim mentality and are pointing the finger to society to make my situation better, it will always fail. What we have to say is, okay, look, if everybody's against us, if the court system's against us, the government's against us, the media's against us, then in Jesus, especially as believers, we'll overcome. And that is only going to make us stronger. That's the point. And that's what I thought Al Sharpton said was important, that the pointing the finger and the outrage can only go so far. Because ultimately, it's nobody else's responsibility to see me move forward or you move forward. And I make no racial distinction in this whatsoever, because we're all human beings, flawed human beings. It's the only race there is, the human race, in need of Jesus. And with his help and grace, we can overcome. Thank you for the call and the comments. Again, friends, look at your own life, wherever you find yourself, and say, I'm not going to blame everybody else. But by God's grace, I am going to overcome. Go to my website right now, askdrbrown.org, askdrbrown.org. If you want to download an entire six-hour teaching by Joe Dallas on reclaiming godly sexuality, tremendously practical, scriptural, helpful, at 60% off, go to askdrbrown.org, askdrbrown.org, and just click on the homepage, the first slide. My bottom line today, life is unfair. Life is unjust. People will hurt you, but don't have the mentality of a victim. Be an overcomer. Well, I know it's Tuesday, but you've got questions. We've got answers today on the Line of Fire. Let's dig into the Word together.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Well, many times on Friday on The Line of Fire, we run out of time. We run out of time on the broadcast. I don't get to answer the selected email questions that are on my desk. I'll answer some of them. Won't get to all of your calls. So I decided to take some extra time today. You've got questions. We've got answers. Anything you want to ask me about, any subject that you want to raise, we'll just make it as wide open as possible. You can even ask for my opinion in an area outside of my expertise, but don't expect an expert answer. We'll dig in the Word. If you've got a question based on Hebrew or Greek, even if it's a Jewish-related question, the phones are open for your questions. I've got some interesting email questions, and I want to talk to you about the mentality of an overcomer. 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. I spent the last hour taking calls, interacting with our listeners about comments by Reverend Jesse Jackson, Dr. Ben Carson, Reverend Al Sharpton, in light of the shooting in Ferguson, Missouri, of my namesake, Michael Brown. And the key point that I wanted to make is, regardless of right or wrong, regardless of who did what, regardless of the outcome of the situation with the police officer and what we find out, regardless of any of that, we must not have a victim mentality. We cannot have a blame game mentality, or we will stagnate or go backwards. And in the Lord, it doesn't matter who comes against us. I mean, doesn't Scripture say in Romans 8, if God is for us, who can be against us? Isn't that what the Word of God says? And when we see in Scripture people completely overwhelmed by opposition, we see people completely overwhelmed by the odds. They trusted in God and God delivered. And what is it that led to the children of Israel dying in the wilderness? You say, well, the golden calf incident. No, that was a terrible sin, but God was still willing to forgive. There was judgment, but to forgive, and they were going to go into the promised land. You say, well, it was their rebellion when they refused to go and they were going to turn back. And yeah, that's true. If you look in Numbers 13 and 14, that's true. But if you look at Numbers 11 and 12, you'll see what it was that led to the rebellion and led to the unbelief. It was grumbling and complaining, And it was a history with the children of Israel. As soon as Moses began to deal with them, even after the Exodus, after seeing God's mighty hand, still, there was grumbling and complaining incessantly. And the grumbling and complaining produced an attitude, an atmosphere of unbelief and outright rebellion. Grumbling and complaining do not build faith. Grumbling and complaining do not increase optimism. Grumbling and complaining do not build hope. Grumbling and complaining do not produce the mentality of an overcomer. In fact, I won't have time now, but right after the break, I want to tell you a story of what happened to me years ago ministering in Finland. It was one of the most graphic examples I've ever experienced in my personal life. Eye-opener about what happens when you repent of grumbling and complaining, and also how out of place it is for believers. Philippians 2, do all things without complaining and arguing. Why? It's God who works in you. It's God who is at work in you and in me. So, special edition of You've Got Questions, We've Got Answers, 866-34-TRUTH. The sky's the limit in what you ask. By the way, if you want to differ with me, it's a good day to call in and tell me why. We'll be right back.
Fire we want, for fire we please, send the fire. It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Yes, it's Tuesday, but you've got questions. We've got answers. The phones are wide open. Any question you want to ask me, anything, Bible, theology, well, anything. Anything you want to ask me, go for it. We'll do our best to answer. 866-348-7884. Okay, before I go to the phones and answer some of your e-questions, some years ago I was ministering in Finland. The first trip there, I went to Finland because the Finnish church was the first to translate my book, Our Hands Are Stained with Blood, into a foreign language. It's been translated many times since. And I wanted to honor them and appreciate their solidarity with Israel. So I went there, and the theme of my meetings for the time I was there, going from city to city, was Israel-related. And once there, the translator and I began to talk. He had translated for, I think, Billy Graham. Other famous Americans had come over. He had translated. And he said, you know, I really think you could help spark revival in the church in Finland, and it would be wonderful if you could come back and focus on that. I said, yeah, I really feel that. I want to minister life, because some of the churches we're in were kind of nominal, others kind of cold. So we set up a three-week meeting, series of meetings. I was going to have another translator, and 3 weeks we're going to go from city to city, 3 or 4 days in each city, drive to the next city, take a plane to the next city, and then preach and minister there. And the first place I show up, and they're advertising these Israel meetings, I said, no, I'm not here for an Israel meeting. They said, no, you are. I said, no, actually, I'm here just for spiritual life. They said, no, you're here for an Israel meeting. I said, what? So these guys shows me in the newspaper, the journalist, he said, no, you're here to speak on Israel. That's what it announced. So I thought, how in the world did that happen? So we talked to some of the folks. They said, oh, we thought we'd draw more people out if we announced it was an Israel meeting. The problem was it would draw a certain crowd, especially an older crowd that had a heart for Israel, as opposed to just the body as a whole for spiritual life and renewal. So I kind of used that message to say, okay, well, here are words that John the Immerser spoke to Israel in the past, and here's how they apply it to church today. And then talked to the translator, made sure the next city they knew why I was coming. I arrived there. I said, okay, why am I here? They said, brother, we want you to sound the alarm, blow the trumpet. I said, perfect, that's why I'm here. And God moved. We had some tremendous meetings. And then get to the next city, and sure enough, as we're walking in, and it was one of the leading Pentecostal churches in all of Finland, as we're walking in for the Sunday morning service, there, I don't know Finnish, it's very different language, but I see on the marquee my name, and something looks like Israel. And I said to the translator, what happened? He said, now, listen, I love to go speak on Israel when that's the theme, and that's what I've agreed to, but that was not the case this time. So he said, I called in advance, I spoke to them, and so on. Same deal. They said, well, we thought we'd get more people if we advertised an Israel meeting. And anyway, so we spoke at the morning service. The associate pastor was there instead of the senior pastor, and he almost seemed a little skeptical towards me. As many years ago, I was a lot younger, too. He seemed a little skeptical towards me, and, oh, yeah, you're going to tell us about repentance, right. So as we're driving to the meeting for Sunday night, and again, it's one of the larger Pentecostal churches in the country. As we're driving there, we're both bellyaching. We're both complaining. We're both, the trip is this, and it's God. You know, as we're driving, the translator and I are complaining, which was not the way either of us would normally be. And we caught ourselves. We said, what are we doing? And we repented. And anyway, that night, we had an outpouring. I mean, that night was one of the greatest meetings I ever had in Finland, and a memorable night overseas in general. And I remember as these teenagers came forward shaking and crying and confessing sin and then being mightily touched by God and mightily filled with the Spirit, mightily overcome with the joy of the Lord, and the whole church at the altar seeking God and being dramatically impacted. We all the more did we say, boy, did we have a wrong attitude coming in, because look at how God moved. And our attitude was so junky. The complaining, it's not going to help. It'll help my flesh, but it's going to hurt everything else. It's going to hurt everything else. Instead, say, Father, I'm hurt, I'm upset, but you are good, you are faithful, and I praise you and I worship you. And in and through him, you can overcome. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Addison. I was going to go to Addison, Texas and start there, but instead I am going to start with an email question. It's a famous one from August 17th from Matt. I've been looking into Mormonism more. This is since listening to my interview with Lynn Wilder, former Mormon and professor at BYU. We had her on some months back and replayed the interview last week, week before. He said, thanks for playing that interview. I've been looking into Mormonism more since then. I was wondering if you could talk about 1 Corinthians 15:29 and what it means. So this, of course, is one of the more obscure passages in the Bible and one that Mormons have used polemically for many years. And in fact, it's the primary support for their notion that you can be baptized for people who had previously died. Now think of that. Think of what a powerful thought that would be. We all are concerned about loved ones. Let's say you come from a Jewish home like I do. Well, that means that your parents, your grandparents, your great-grandparents, and so on were not believers in Jesus Yeshua. If they had been, you would have been raised in that. But like me, I was just raised in a conservative Jewish home because my parents were not believers. My dad died in 1977. He had, at that point, been reading the New Testament. He had come to church services and heard me preach. And I thought, okay, just a matter of time before his heart fully opens and he receives the Lord. He fully received me as a believer. But then he died suddenly. At the age of 63, died suddenly of a heart attack. We saw him one night. We were over at the house. 3 hours later, got the call that he was gone. Where is he? God knows. Of course, I hope in mercy, and I hope that the time before he died, his heart was open, and I know he was seeking, but only God knows. Well, what if someone said, hey, not just your father, my mom's still alive, 91, pray that she'll come to the Lord. She doesn't resist at all, she just doesn't know him. But what about his father, whom I never met, and my grandmother, who I knew very little as a little boy? What about Jewish parents on my mother's side, whom I never met? And what about generations back? What if I could be baptized for them and they get in? Somehow that my getting baptized for them gets them in. Think of that. Wouldn't that have appeal? Wouldn't that have power? Of course, it's false. It's a myth. If you're listening as a Mormon, it's a myth. Doesn't matter what anyone tells you. It's a myth. So you say, what about 1 Corinthians 15:25? Paul's whole discussion there in 1 Corinthians 15 is about the literal resurrection of the dead, correct? Many of you are familiar with it. And if the dead don't rise, then Jesus never rose. If Jesus never rose, then we have no hope. So he's talking about the resurrection, all right? That's a whole point that he's making. And then he asks this question. If the dead don't rise, that's what leads up to it, verse 29. I'll read it in a few translations. King James, else what shall they do which are baptized for the dead if the dead rise not at all? Why are they then baptized for the dead? New King James, why are they then baptized for the dead? The Christian Standard Bible, Holman Christian Standard Bible, if the dead are not raised at all, then why are people baptized for them? ESV, if the dead are not raised at all, why are people baptized on their behalf? And on, you see that is pretty much a straightforward translation. NET, if the dead are not raised at all, then why are they baptized for them? NLT, if the dead, well, this is mild paraphrase, if the dead will not be raised, what point is there in being baptized for those who are dead? Why do it unless the dead will someday rise again? Ancient Syriac translation in English, if not, what will those who are baptized for the dead do for the dead? If the dead do not rise, why are they baptized for the dead? ? Okay, so this is obviously a major question. What does it mean? Now, I'd like to just give you a simple answer so as to refute Mormon error, but there is no simple answer, not because Mormons are right, but simply we don't know exactly what Paul meant. We know there's not a stitch of evidence in the New Testament and a stitch of evidence elsewhere in the early church and in reputable documents that says that you can be baptized for someone else. Not a stitch of evidence that says you can be baptized for someone else's salvation. Everywhere it is addressed, People are called on to respond, to repent and believe, to believe and be baptized without fail. And then you are the one who, through baptism, symbolically dies to sin, and now you rise in newness of life. So that's a given. That's a given. So what does this actually mean? There's several different interpretations that have been suggested. One is that it is baptism with respect to the dead, with respect to resurrection. And other suggestions that it could tie in with Jewish customs of the day. So we'll come back. I'll expand on that a moment on the other side of the break.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back, friends, to the Line of Fire broadcast, 866-34-TRUTH. So just finishing up the answer to 1 Corinthians 15:29. If you're a Mormon, want to call in and differ with me, that's perfectly fine, as we speak to so many of you in Utah right now. So, Craig Keener, always with good summaries where there is background material, says this in his IVP Bible background commentary. Here, baptized for the dead may mean that a Christian friend was baptized for a symbolic effect on behalf of a new convert who had died, perhaps by martyrdom, although we know of no major persecution in Corinth, or perhaps on his or her deathbed, thus allowing no time for baptism. So Keener's saying it's possible. It could mean that, in other words, the text could mean that, but it is nothing to do with someone who was not a believer. Perhaps, he's saying, they had a custom of being baptized for someone who had come to faith but was unable to get baptized, came to faith and were immediately martyred or something like that, so they did it on their behalf. Is it possible? It could be. It's highly unlikely, but possible. Now, by the way, Paul is not saying it's right or wrong. He's just asking, why are you doing it? If the dead don't rise, why are you doing it? And that's really the bigger question. If the dead don't rise, what's the purpose of this particular rite that you are practicing? Keener says this, although there is no evidence of vicarious baptism in ancient Judaism, posthumous symbols could be employed. In other words, after death, symbols. For instance, if someone was to be executed, Jewish teachers said that his death could atone for his sins. If he died before he could be executed, however, the people placed a stone on the coffin, symbolically enacting his stoning so that his execution would still count with God. Or, this expression may refer to washings of the dead before burial. So the Greek word baptism can also refer to a ritual washing, not specifically baptism of repentance, but just a ritual washing. He said this expression may refer to washings of the dead before burial, a standard Jewish custom. Religious groups in the ancient Mediterranean supervised the burials of their own members. It could also be a roundabout way of saying baptized so as to be able to participate in eternal life with Christians who have already died, hence baptized in the light of their own mortality as well. Many ancient pagans sought to honor the dead, for example, by putting meals at their tombs. To whatever practice Paul alludes, it is not clear whether he agrees with the Corinthian practice. Even if he does not, however, he can use it to make his point. Again, the point is, why are you doing this if the dead don't rise? Here, it would almost be like asking the question, all right? And I'll use a little bit different analogy. But if you will look in the Egyptian tombs, you'll see that the Pharaoh was buried with servants. He was buried with food. He was buried with favorite items. Obviously, the assumption was that he would go on living after death. Otherwise, there was no reason to do that. Now, obviously, custom is not a right custom. The Pharaoh was not going to live again in that state, but it did point to something, that they believed that he would live beyond death. So the same way, that could be Paul's question. You have this custom in your midst of baptism for the dead, whatever it means. Why do it if the dead are not going to rise? So it would seem to be speaking clearly, not of the person being baptized, but of what that person is connecting with. But then, as Keener said, it could simply be a matter of ritual washings. All right, why are you doing that? Why are you doing ritual washings for the dead, as is common in Judaism, before burial? If the dead are not going to rise, why take this particular care? So we don't know for sure. That's the most honest answer. What we can be sure was that the church did not teach what the Mormons teach. That's a fact. 866-34-TRUTH. Oh, let me just see if there's another question I can get to here. I think the same guy that wrote in some very nasty anti-Israel, almost anti-Jewish questions before. So I think I responded to one that's more than enough. But let me just open this one up a little bit further, all right? This is from Steve. Hi, Dr. Brown. I hope this is the correct avenue to reach you, as I'm in Australia and listen to you online. That works, sir. I heard a question from a listener regarding the dispute over the date of the authorship of the book of Daniel. Can we take the translation of the Hebrew scriptures into Greek by the Septuagint about 3 centuries before Christ and therefore before the prophecies as historical evidence for an authorship of about 300 BC or before? And I answered that very briefly on Friday. Let me just take a moment longer. For those who are not familiar, critical scholars question that the book of Daniel goes back to the time it claims, namely the 6th century before Jesus. For a number of reasons, they claim it is written much later, perhaps 150 or 200 years before the time of Jesus. And they would say that's why in the Hebrew canon of Scripture, it's not included with the prophets. In the canon that we use, which follows the Septuagint, an ancient Greek translation made by Jewish scholars a couple hundred years before the time of Jesus, Daniel is along with Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel. So Lamentations is in there, but Daniel is in there. In the Hebrew canon, it's part of a separate section called the Writings, so it's not grouped together with Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, or the 12 minor prophets. Some argue that's why. And you know, how much presence does it have in Dead Sea Scrolls? And does that point to lateness? And these questions come up. Other scholars say, actually, if you'll study the Aramaic of Daniel, because Daniel chapter 2, verse 4 to Daniel chapter 7, verse 28 is written in Aramaic, that you'll see that that reflects an older style, a style that would be in keeping with authorship in the 6th century before Jesus. So the question about the Septuagint, if the Septuagint was completed, the Greek translation completed 300 years before Jesus, and Daniel's part of that, wouldn't that point to an earlier date for Daniel? Yeah, but that's not accurate. Parts of the Septuagint were translated in the third century BC, part the second century BC, and it's very possible that the part of the Septuagint where Daniel was translated was a later part as well. It's very likely. So that wouldn't prove it. The better arguments would be linguistic, based on the Aramaic of Daniel. And ultimately, we take the account as a truthful account of the miracles that God performed and the revelations that he gave, some of which apply to the past and some which still applies to the future. Can I ask you an honest question? Have you ever struggled with sexual temptation since you've been a believer? Ever? Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Some say, yeah, on a daily basis, I have to watch my eyes, I have to be careful on the internet, be careful with my thought life, TV, media. You ever had issues with your kids in terms of their sexuality? Heterosexual issues, homosexual issues, different things come up. Well, there's a terrific 6-hour teaching series that Joe Dallas did for us, one of the top men in the nation to teach on these issues. Simple, practical, scriptural, clear teaching on reclaiming godly sexuality, which touches on all the major issues. To take the class in person was $40 or $50. We put it on a CD to listen to on your computer MP3 player, dropped the price to $25. But it's yours for your gift of any size. Be as generous as you can, stand with us, but your gift of any size. Call now 1-800-278-9978. 1-800-278-9978. Once more, 1-800-278-9978. We'll be right back.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back, friends, to the Line of Fire broadcast. Taking questions, I'm about to respond to some questions that are being sent in. 866-34-TRUTH, anything that you want to ask me, talk about, question, raise, differ with me, get more insight on. Sky is the limit as we're taking some extra time to do it today since we often run out of time on Friday answering your questions when we normally do. You've got questions, we've got answers. 866-34-TRUTH. But before I do that, I just want to mention something. If you're going to live by public opinion, you're going to die by public opinion. I listen carefully to constructive feedback. If I see overwhelmingly people responding a certain way, let's say people who like me and agree with me and appreciate me, and they all respond a certain way or overwhelmingly differing with me on something or feeling I was insensitive, I'll look at that carefully. If I write something that I think is amazing and it's really going to go viral when I write it and people are going to read it, you know, it's going to spread like fire, and it doesn't get read that much, I think, okay, maybe something, either the way it was written or the subject matter was not as great as I thought. It didn't have the impact that I thought it would. At the same time, if you look at comments posted to my articles, one will be praising me, the other ready to kill me. If you look at responses that people post on Facebook, if you look at, quote, reviews, you can actually review a Facebook page, the fan page. So my Ask Dr. Brown page has a lot of reviews because the issues that we address, maybe it's 965 or something, I have to check, but, you know, 900-something, close to 1,000 five-star reviews and 100, some, I don't know, 130 or 40 one-star reviews. So, okay, it's maybe 9 or 10 to 1 in favor or standing with me or 8 to 1, whatever the numbers are. But if you're going to live by the good reports, you're going to die by the bad reports. So look at this, Hyper Grace, okay? Here's a review. Oh, let me find this one. Where is it? Okay. Review of my Hyper Grace book. I think the author should remember when he was being attacked with 4 or 5 exclamation points. This book grieved me. I remember when Dr. Brown was being attacked violently and with misquotes. He wrote 2 books having to defend what was a genuine move of God at Brownsville. He was slandered, misquoted, and criticized. I was online with him. It was nasty. Now he is doing the same thing with Joseph Prince and others. Shame, shame, shame. Because of this repugnant attitude and his misquotes, I am placing this book with others in the same category, counterfeit miracles, counterfeit revival, and others who misquote and slander. Shame, shame, shame. Don't buy this book. It lies and misquotes, multiple exclamation points. Someone asked him, since I wrote the whole book very graciously and document every point, to document some of this. Of course, he never responded. Now, contrast that with this review. These are all within the last 8 days. It is refreshing to finally find another pastor teacher. There seem to be only a handful these days who can articulate well the concerns with the Hyper Grace doctrine movement. And ironically, you could say that Dr. Brown demonstrates hyper grace throughout the book. So hyper grace towards those I differ with. In regard to the exemplary manner in which he expresses his concerns and positions, that is, I cannot think of anyone I've heard on radio or TV at a national level who handles dialogue debate as respectfully and graciously as he does. I highly recommend this book for anyone interested in giving a thorough examination to what the word really says about grace. Now, I'm looking on Amazon, out of the 171 reviews posted, there are 127 five-star and 15 one-star. So overwhelmingly, almost 10 to 1, the five-star outrates the one-star. So people are appreciating the book. And I had people criticize me for being too gracious towards those I differed with. So if I'm going to put all my stock in the positive review, what am I going to do with the negative review? So I just want to encourage you. When there's genuine encouragement, take it. When there's genuine constructive criticism, take it. But otherwise, smile and keep moving. We'll be right back.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks for joining us on the Line of Fire. We've opened the phone lines for a special Tuesday edition. If you've got questions, we've got answers. Plan to do our normal Friday one, but just wanted to tackle some extra issues. Before I go to the phones, let's see. Ben asks, and I hope you're listening, Ben, because I'm not responding online. Brother Michael, please clarify the difference on New Testament and Old Testament concept of Satan or the devil. From my limited research, there seems to be of some face value differences. In short, we get a much fuller revelation of Satan in the New Testament, Satan, demonic activity, but it builds on the Old Testament revelation. What we see more clearly is the degree to which Satan is adversarial to God and the degree to which we as followers of Jesus know about him and have authority over him. That would be a very, very simple answer and perhaps one that I can get into at greater length. So, A, much more understanding of Satan and the demonic realm in the New Testament. B, a clearer understanding of his adversarial position against God and his kingdom, although still ultimately being under God. In other words, God can always stop anything whenever he wants to because he has all authority. Satan, ha-satan in Hebrew, means the adversary or the accuser, but best the adversary. And then lastly, through the cross and resurrection of Jesus and the infilling of the Spirit, we have power and authority over Satan, which would be a concept little known in the Old Testament, hinted at the end of Psalm 91, but otherwise little known. All right, let's go to the phones, 866-34-TRUTH. Michelle in Charlotte, North Carolina, thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Hello.
Hey, you're on the air.
Yes, I have a question about Reverend Sharpton. It bothers me that we have these ministers who claim to be Christian, but out there just sparking so much energy that's negative. And can someone, I'm trying not to make a judgment call, but yet at the same time, how can you not? I mean, they're just out there, seems like causing trouble. Can you answer anything to that?
Sure, glad to answer, Michelle. Interestingly, the last hour I played some clips from Al Sharpton at the funeral of Michael Brown, my namesake, that was killed in Ferguson, Missouri. And I said that it's the first time I can remember really agreeing with some points that he made. We had a whole discussion about that in the last hour. But let's understand this. There is in Black America, there is a higher percentage of church going and a greater respect of the pastoral office or reverend or bishop. So many of the leaders did have church background, ministry background, just like Dr. Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement came out of the churches. So it's much more a cultural norm to have civic leaders who are also reverends. But in many cases, and just like in the Old Testament, someone was called a prophet, even if they were a false prophet, because that was what they did, and if they're a false prophet, let it be so. So I have no problem referring to Reverend Sharpton and Reverend Jackson. They are no different in many respects than white Christian leaders who are very liberal, who deny certain fundamentals of the faith, and who agitate for all types of social causes that I would profoundly differ with, who are on the front lines of agitating for a redefining marriage, who are on the front lines of agitating for pro-abortion, who are on the front lines of agitating against Israel. So what happens is, at certain key times in our history, Al Sharpton, Jesse Jackson will rise up, and what many white Americans will hear is rhetoric that just seems more harmful than helpful. On the flip side, there are white American leaders that are in the churches that do the same thing. We may not just notice it because it's kind of an ongoing thing as opposed to something that just happens, at an incendiary moment like this. But it's a great question. I think we just have to recognize it's more of a widespread phenomenon than we might understand. And again, in the Black culture, there's much more esteem for reverend, pastor, bishop. Church life is more part of life than in much of white America. Hence, these types of gatherings, a funeral service would be very much of a church service. Thank you for the call. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Dave in St. Louis, Missouri. Thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Hi. I had a question concerning the millennial reign. I kind of understand that Ezekiel chapter 40 through 48 is talking about the millennial reign. Mm-hmm. And in Ezekiel 44, it discusses priests and it gives certain conditions to the priests upon who they're allowed to marry. And so my question was, is there going to be marriage in the millennium? And how does that work with Yeshua's, Jesus's comments in Matthew 22, I believe it is, when the Sadducees asked him, you know, who is this woman who's been married to six different people who she's going to be married to in the millennium and are at the resurrection? And he responds that, you know, nobody will be getting married or be given into marriage.
Yeah. Yeah, great question. And the simple answer would be that if we are rightly understanding the millennial kingdom, that those who are believers will be glorified when Jesus returns. All right, so we are caught up to meet him in the air and escort him back. We are glorified. We are now resurrected. We have now stepped fully into that eternal age, and there'll be no marrying among us. There'll be no marrying, reproducing, anything like that. Those that live in the millennial kingdom on the earth, according to Zechariah 14, would be the survivors of the nations that attacked Jerusalem. So these are human beings, but it seems that in a new world with different conditions and with Jesus ruling and reigning on the earth, that life expectancy is radically changed. And that's addressed in the book of Isaiah, where it speaks in the 65th chapter, no more shall there be an infant who lives but a few days, or an old man who does not fill out his days, for the young man shall die 100 years old, and the sinner 100 years old shall be accursed. So that seems to be what will happen in the millennial kingdom, which could then, because you just got regular human beings, there'll be marriage, there'll be reproduction. At the end of that time, if we're rightly understanding this, Revelation 20 speaks of a final rebellion against the Lord when Satan is released and seduces mankind. And the lesson would be, I don't know if you're drinking some water there or what, but the lesson, Dave, would be that even in a perfect kingdom with Jesus ruling and reigning, there will still be people who want to rebel against the laws of God. The problem with interpretation is the same passage in Isaiah, for example, speaks of a new heaven and a new earth, which clearly is the eternal age. So are things kind of overlapping and put together? 2 Peter 3 would do the same thing. Could well be. But if, in fact, as we understand, there is a thousand-year millennial kingdom, for those who are entering that kingdom, not us, those who are resurrected, ruling and reigning with Jesus, but those who physically enter the kingdom as human beings, sure, no reason that there wouldn't be marriage and that there wouldn't be children being born with extended lifespans. Hey, thank you for the question, Dave. I do appreciate it. 866-34-TRUTH. Milton is wondering, how do you reprimand, correct a pastor who has no one to answer to? Milton, it's not an ideal situation to be in a congregation with a completely unaccountable leader. Now, it could be a church plant. I understand that. It could be, you know, eight people in the congregation, and the pastor's led them to the Lord. He's leading them, and he doesn't have anyone to raise up with him. He should have some type of outside accountability or outside leaders that he respects. But it would always be wrong for a believer to rebuke an elder, just like it would be wrong for a child to rebuke a parent. I'm not saying it's the same relationship, but the parallel, that there's still an honoring of authority or of eldership. And what you do is you appeal to the person. If it's clear that there's wrong, you appeal to that person. If they refuse to hear, and there's no one else you can appeal to, in other words, there's no outside group, there is no board, there are no elders, there are no senior leaders in the city or community that the person would listen to. If you feel it's a grievous thing and the response is wrong, then you graciously leave and you pray for that person's repentance and freedom in the Lord. You don't decide, I'm going to now mount this attack and call the whole church to listen to me, because even if you're in the right, the way you're approaching it would be in the wrong. 866-34-TRUTH. Brad asks, through God's grace, can we live a sinless life? Philippians 4:13, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. He says, I can. Do I agree? Nope. Well, theoretically, yes, but in reality in this world, nope. I'll explain why when we come back.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks for joining us on the Line of Fire. This question was asked, can I lead a sinless life in Jesus? Philippians 4:13, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Well, obviously all things in context. Can you fly like a bird? Can you swim underwater for 10 hours without coming up to get your breath through Christ who strengthens you? Well, He has not called us to do those particular things. You say, but yeah, but He has called us to be perfect as His Father is perfect and to be holy. Correct. But the New Testament constantly speaks to us about purification, about growth. The New Testament writers are dealing with sin issues in basically every one or almost every one of their letters, which is telling me that to live perfectly without sin doesn't happen in this world. That's my goal every day. My goal every day is to please the Lord and not to sin, right? I don't start the day saying, oh, I'm going to sin a lot. Well, I'll sin a little because I'm a believer. No, I want to please the Lord, period. But even my best day, there are things that I didn't do that I wasn't even aware of. There were ways where I fell short, where I didn't perfectly love God, perfectly love my neighbor. If I understand fully the holiness and perfection of God and my shortcomings as a human being, then I'll understand why John writes, 1 John, writing to believers, not to unbelievers, writing to believers. If we say we haven't sinned, if we say we're without sin, we deceive ourselves. We make God a liar. His truth is not in us. Rather, we are continually being purified. And the call is to continually purify ourselves. So we grow in grace and we seek to become like Jesus, but we recognize in this world we will not be sinless. And those people that have told me they live sinless lives are normally pretty nasty and ornery. But of course, they're just being righteous. I've seen that a lot. I'm not saying that's the case with the gentleman that asked this question, Brad, but that's my response. To Rick in Rock Hill, South Carolina, thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Yes, Dr. Brown, I have a question. In my church, we're starting to endorse the acceptance of homosexuality. And I went to my preacher, and he's trying to tell me that the word abomination doesn't mean sin. And that's really confusing, because I thought that was something very detestable. And I just don't think that that's in God's plan for human beings to live this way. What does that abomination mean?
Yeah, it literally means something detestable. And in the context of Leviticus 18, it's in the context of adultery, incest, bestiality, and homosexual practice is specifically called an abomination among abominations in Leviticus 18. And in different settings in the Old Testament, it can be used of pride, it can be used of murder, it can be used of idolatry. So he's trying to say it just means something ritually impure. Sometimes it does, but in this case, it is talking about a serious sexual violation, which in the Old Testament, I'm not advocating this today, God forbid, but in the Old Testament, where Israel was under God's law as a theocracy, the penalty for this was death. So what kind of church is this, Rick?
This is a Baptist church, but they belong to a cooperative. They went out of the Southern Baptist convention and went into this cooperative Baptist, and a lot of people did, you know, we got switched out of the Southern Baptist Association into the cooperative Baptist, and I'm it's where a lot of people, a lot of older people are really confused.
Yeah, well, what they need to do, if the pastor will not repent of this, it's only going to go south quickly. It's only going to turn into a strong welcoming. Listen, we want to welcome everyone to come and hear the gospel. And we want to love on everyone, regardless of who they are, what's going on in their lives. But if they claim to be followers of Jesus practicing homosexuality at the same time, that cannot be. If there are churches now, many of them, that will ordain someone practicing homosexual with a partner and ordain them into ministry. So that's how far things go. My heart goes out to all those struggling, but we cannot lower the word of God to where we are. So what your pastor's done, he's picked up on some false information that's widely disseminated, and he's going down the wrong path. Do you think, how many folks are in the church?
We've got about 500 members, something like that.
Yeah, well, yeah, if he's willing to read a book that will tell him something very different on this, ask him, and if that's the case, we'll send you a free copy. Just shoot us an email at info@askdrbrown.org. Info@askdrbrown.org. Ask him if he's willing to read the book. If he is and he changes his tune, great. If not, best for you to just make a quiet exodus and find another church in the area, because that's a very serious error that's only going to lead to more error. So again, if he says he's willing, shoot us a note at info@askdrbrown.org. Say, Dr. Brown wanted to send that book about homosexuality, and we'll send it out. Okay?
That's good. And like I read in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, tells us how to possess our vessel.
Exactly.
Sanctification, honor. And I feel like, oh my goodness, we're just really, really not doing it, because he says he called us to not the uncleanness, but to holiness.
100%. And it's impossible for two men or two women to be in a holy, romantic, and sexual relationship, no matter how much they care about each other. Holiness can only be found in marital intimacy, sexual holiness, the way God ordained it, which is one man and one woman for life. Hey, Rick, thank you for the call. And of course, this is going to continue to happen around the country. It's bad news, but the good news is it will help bring a needed separation. Laurel, Dr. Brown, could you please offer a response to the question, why do we follow some traditions in the Old Testament but not others? I respect your program and your work, and thank you for it. Currently listening to your interview with Robin Steinberg. This is a new YouTube video that was done from Singapore to the States. In short, Laurel, if something was just given to Israel to keep them separate from the nations and is not reinforced in the Torah as being for all people, and it's not reinforced in the prophetic books as being for the nations, and is not reinforced in the New Testament, then you learn from it, but you do not think it applies to you. On the flip side, look at it the positive way. If something is emphasized, this is for all people in the Torah, this is abomination or a command for all people, all nations, and the prophets reemphasize it, and the New Testament reemphasizes it, then you live by it. Very simple. And, all right, okay. Dan, the question about the Talmud saying that girls as young as 3 could be raped and it means nothing. No, no, no. What it's talking about, I can't get to Numbers passage at the moment, but Talmudic passage is saying if a girl through a physical accident, riding a horse or a broken stick or something, loses her physical virginity, it's nothing. She should still be counted a virgin. That's what it's talking about. Not that you can rape her and it means nothing. Yeah. My book, Our Hands Are Stained with Blood, actually deals with that lie, among others. All right, friends, don't forget you've got a special opportunity to get a tremendous 6-hour teaching by Joe Dallas on reclaiming godly sexuality. Normally the CD is $25 plus postage, 6-hour class to listen to on your computer MP3 player. But this week only, yours for your gift of any size. Just be as generous as you can. Help us reach more and more people. But take advantage of this offer. 1-800-278-9978. 1-800-278-9978. My bottom line today, you know, a lot of things we thought they were simple and clear, they really are simple and clear.